Hi there. Good evening, everyone. Can you all hear?
Yes.
Oh, that's encouraging. Okay. Well, right. The format for this evening, very briefly, is I'm going to introduce Roger, and Roger's going to introduce his sons, and then the floor is really open to you guys to bombard them with questions. Okay. So I'd just like to start by saying that I've known Roger for 20 years now, and really, this is a man who's done just about everything there is to do in pinball. For me, my first knowledge of Roger was the book he wrote, Pinball. And I also learned that from the time before I knew him, he was involved with dealing with the bureaucrats in New York to get pinball legalised. And I think that's very important for all of us, because from that, in those early days, I think pinball was probably legal in about three states before your involvement, but after your involvement...
It was around. I mean, if you look at it, not wanting to preempt, you have New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles as being the three major metropolitan areas domestically where pinball wasn't allowed. From 1941 until 1972 for Los Angeles, 1941 until 1976 for New York and Chicago. So, if you're looking at a population base of, 7-8 million people back then, those people didn't have any access to pinball.
What, now there's 300 million people here in the United States now?
There is now. Okay.
And thanks to you, they've all got access to pinball.
Scary.
What an issue, okay? Then, apart from, as if that wasn't enough, for about 14 years, Roger was the pinball critic in Playmeter magazine, and... since stepping down from that, he's handed the mantle over to his children, which now, I guess, is a family tradition.
I suppose.
Isn't that just amazing? And
if they're around long enough, there'll be grandchildren if the industry is still around.
Well, let's all hope. Let's all hope. And then Roger's also been involved in designing six pinball machines?
Yes.
I've got some names here. Stingray, which Roger had to remind me was not on my list. Cyclops, Global Warfare, which I actually helped track down 1 million years ago. Sharpshooter, Lady Sharpshooter, and Las Vegas, which when it finally hit the streets will probably be recognisable to you guys as Barracuda, but originally the name it had was Las Vegas. Roger has also been instrumental in negotiating many, many pinball licenses for Williams, and more recently, as a consultant, he's been doing that for Stern. And I guess, you know, Roger's latest license is out there on the floor today because it's Pirates of the Caribbean. So with that, I'd like to hand over the microphone to Roger to introduce his two boys.
Thank you. As Rob well knows, I have not done too many of these over the years. I think, 22 years, this is probably the third chat I've done. It's not something I've ever been really comfortable with. But having said that, that's right. So I have my anchors on either side, and to the point that Rob had said before, and Gary as well, it's not as if I've come with any kind of canned presentation. I don't think that I would ever assume that there's a particular single subject that, you know, I want to just pontificate on and want to have it be an open forum. So to that end, let me introduce my sons, because truthfully there's much that they've been doing with pinball, and hopefully we'll be getting into that. And hopefully as well, there may be some curiosity as to what the influence of pinball has been in their lives. It's my son, Joshua. And my son, Zachary. I guess, ranked respectively, fourth and ninth in the world?
Third.
Third? Oh, excuse me. I haven't kept up.
It just came out November.
Oh, okay. One of the things that my sons are very much involved with, and for those who are potentially competing or watching it, is the pin brawl upstairs. I know that they've done some things with leagues as a follow-up to what Steve Epstein and I had done and creating Papa. And more importantly, they brought Steve and I back from the dead to kind of co-direct and oversee the, I guess, the reemergence of the IFPA, International Flipper Pinball Association. Thank you, Jim. And the purpose of that, truthfully, is to try to give some connectivity to all the various events that take place around the world, not the least of which is Pinball Expo and the great flip-offs that they've been doing for since the beginning of time. But truthfully, IFPA Pinball has a mandate of wanting to support, wanting to endorse a variety of events and activities, and hopefully by doing that, make pinball a little bit more accessible, a little bit more visible, create some of the promotional and publicity push that we were able to do with the New York Papa tournaments over the years, Steve Epstein and myself, and with Joshua and Zachary being on the front lines, not only playing, but also overseeing and organizing. Hopefully, when I run out of steam, at least they can pick up the mantle. And to that point, what Gary had mentioned, Playmeter I wrote for 14 years, was the first critic, I guess, for the game industry. And I guess for how long now? Last 3-4 years?
99 was our first.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
God, see, I don't see them a lot, so I'm just going to sit here and I'll be surprised by what they say. But Playmeter wound up going back to them and seeing if they would resurrect Critics Corner. It was, I guess, very well received for the number of years that I was writing for it, and there is now Critics Corner 2. Where they are reviewing games, pinball, as well as video and novelty redemption, what have you. So, without further ado, I will. Yes.
I have a family question, which I think is probably high on your agenda. It seems like every month for the past 5 months, you've been issuing a press release with a new URL. So we've had the latest World Series of Pinball.com or something like that. IFPA. So how many more of these do you do before you achieve complete world domination?
Well, in all seriousness, I think that the World Series of Pinball concept, which was a fellow by the name of Frank Abruzzo, I think. Azero. Thank you. Was somebody who had approached me saying that he had obviously this website, he had gotten this name together, and he thought that that would be a great umbrella. There was an announcement that was made in the trades. There was something that he had on his website for a day until I found out about it. I'm not really a great visitor when it comes to the news groups or anything else, truthfully, guys. I leave that to my sons, and they tell me, here's the link. Click on it and see what's going on. So that's my way of trying to stay up to date. I was more than willing to sit down and talk with him and discuss, are there some synergies? What does he bring to the party other than just, you know, this World Series of Pinball name? We've kind of nipped that in the bud, and when he comes back with something that's more substantive and something that really makes sense for us, then fine. But truthfully, I mean, you're really looking at IFPA Pinball, and you're looking at the WPPR, which is the World Pinball Player Rankings that Josh and Zach and their friends have been able to pull together as this, well, here, explain.
Wait one second. We'll get to you, sir.
For those that don't know, the World Pinball Player Rankings track most of the people that are playing upstairs right now, and it's through pretty much every tournament you can find across the world, at least that I know about. So we try to kind of bring the universe together to fight for the greater good. Sorry, Steve. To fight for the greater good of competitive pinball.
I think there's about 80 events that we're now tracking or so.
Yeah, I mean,
nationally, from Japan to Europe, domestically.
Yeah, there's 18 countries right now and a tournament every weekend somewhere.
Okay, so follow up. So you mentioned a few weeks ago about IFPA endorsing tournaments.
Yes.
Is that going to be at some higher level of endorsement than simply saying this tournament is authorized to grant WPPR points?
It's sometimes as easy as that, and there's other times when I've gotten my dad and Steve and us two to run a tournament like we did at the AMOA show.
Carla.
Zach just ran one with Steve Epstein in Pennsylvania, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, probably. And Are those the only two we've done so far?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, truthfully,
Oh, yeah, we also ran the
first Milwaukee.
Yeah, the Midwest Gaming Classic in Milwaukee in June. So we're here, instead of just, I mean, the easiest way for us to exist is, hey, give us your results and we'll, you know, put them together. Hey, that's easy. We'll take all the credit for all you guys, for what you guys are doing. But truthfully, we're here to help people get organized, and the events we've been able to help out with, we're having a show, but they didn't have a tournament before. So now they've added a tournament to their lineup, and the players have, you know, come and they play and earn points for themselves, and it's just a way for them to try to get out and support these smaller shows. I mean, Rob and Mike have been able to put on a show for 22 years. A lot of these shows are in their first, second, third year, and it's tough to, you know, break the bank to have a show the following year. So we're just looking to, the more places for people to play pinball, the better.
Yeah, I mean, the more exposure that we can provide. I mean, a classic example was last month at the AMOA and having a pinball tournament there.
Oh, okay. And having a pinball at the AMOA. AMOA is the amusement industry trade show, for those who are not familiar with it. And what was interesting was that the show was combined with Fun Expo. And Fun Expo is a lot of things that have to do with amusement parks. Miniature golf centers, soft plush things, a lot of food, product. And then there was another show that was also tied in, which was a gifts and souvenir show. Totally separate from our industry, although truthfully there was a lot of product there that you might find in the World of Redemption, for again those who are familiar with that aspect of the business. And what we were able to do was to run an open for people who are not involved in either of the industries, any of the industries, and have them come in, and again under the guidance of an IFPA event, under the opportunity to gain WPPR points and trying to validate and legitimize the event. But more importantly, we also had an industry event. So similar to what Rob and Mike do with Pinball Expo, where you have a manufacturer's division, we had an open division and we had an industry division. And the part that was fantastic was, it's a great story. You're trying to sell the dream. Best way to describe it. We had a great setup on the floor in Las Vegas at the convention center. And the people within the industry kind of know AMOA as an industry association and gotten the word out. And you're trying to tell people, come on over and play. This is what the rules are. It's going to be $10 an entry. The money is going toward charity to benefit AMOA. And also Tim Arnold, who, you know, thank God for Timmy. He was fantastic in providing games. And we were able to generate some monies for his charities that he supports. And there was a fellow walking by, it's like, hi, come on, come on. He said, no, I'm with this convention in the back, just the way the setup was. So the setup was, if you walked in, on the right side was AMOA, on the left side was Fun Expo, and in the back was his gifts and souvenir show. All right? And these people are just kind of walking by. It's not like they're there to play video games and to see what they want to potentially purchase for their locations. And it's told the guys, no, there's an industry division, you can play in this. Oh, wow, okay, and it's $10, it goes for a worthwhile cause, and we sold the guy on playing. And Steve took down the information, whatever else, and I kept score for him. And his first round of three games that he played were not that good, and as I was filling it in, I said, oh, he made a mistake, you don't want to play in the open, you want to play in the industry thing. And he said, no, I'll play in the open. Eventually, the guy wound up qualifying as one of the top four players against some of the finest competition that exists in this country for pinball playing. A lot of the guys who come out for Expo as well. Let his wife take over the booth. I mean, he was there like nonstop. And toward the end, we had somebody who originally, when I told him, you don't want to play in this, he said, I used to be really good years ago. I just haven't played in a while. So if we can convert one person to an experience like that over a two-day period of time, think of what we can do in multiple locations trying to work with people. And I think that the important point really to stress is that what we are doing, and to answer further, isn't just slapping a label on something and endorsing it. We're willing to help create a structure. If there is a way to do sponsorships, if there's a way to direct publicity in a particular way, we'll work hand in hand with any event organizer, any location that wants to do something. And truthfully, within the industry division, a fellow by the name of Steve Belmonte out of Massachusetts, Patriot Vending. If you remember his name. He just loved it. He got jazzed about it. He operates games. Excuse me. Has not operated a lot of pinball over the years, but this opened his eyes to something that maybe he could actually institute in his daily business. So if we can do those kinds of things, open these doors, Gary Stern's going to be very happy, and hopefully the rest of all of us are going to be happy, because maybe it can, again, elicit some more excitement and a little bit more interest and support for pinball. So, without being long-winded, yes?
This question's for Zach.
Good.
Okay, Zach.
Serious?
You're born, right? You get used to the mustache with eyes, and you're not afraid anymore. All right, then you know, you kind of become cognizant of what's going on. You know, you're still very young, but, you know, you're beginning to hear and understand already. What game did you hear first? What game did you play first?
What game did I play first?
Yeah.
Wow.
He'd probably know the answer to that better.
Dan? Maybe Jack in the Box, but probably Funland?
No, probably Jack in the Box.
Jack in the Box. I went to let you play Cowpoke or Buckaroo.
Yeah, we still can.
Right.
Off limits.
That was off limits.
Okay. So
Jack in the Box.
It might have been Evil.
What?
Evil.
It might have been Evil?
Evil Knievel.
Or Flash.
Okay. Or Flash.
Thank you. I can't really remember back that far.
I didn't ask you that question. I got
let me interject.
No, I'm not even talking to you yet.
I have to do an aside.
Wait, hold up.
Take the mic if you're going to speak.
All right.
I have to do an aside. I mean, and then I'll let them jump in because, of course, I'm shy and I don't like to talk a lot. But in this particular instance, the one thing, and it started with Joshua, absolutely followed up with Zachary. They were both born in New York City. I had a studio apartment. Actually, a little bit bigger than the studio, but studio apartment, then we moved into a little bit larger space. But I had 5 games in our living room. And to get
them... Well, hasn't changed.
Right, I know. It hasn't changed. But to get them to sleep, I used to put the games on, and one of the games, obviously, with Evel Knievel, for those who remember it, you had the motorcycle, the bike, and I remember rocking them to sleep on the chair, just looking at all of the lights and everything else. So they were exposed to pinball, I mean, literally from that first point in time when you have a baby that you can't get down. What else can I do here?
Okay,
We'll get to your question. But I do remember he took a lot of pictures when we were kids. What was it?
Trailing off for me. I don't mean to make it loud for everybody, but what are you saying?
He took a lot of pictures when we were babies, and before I can remember playing, there's pictures of me playing, and I mean, I think second birthday, first birthday, playing Evel Knievel on a stool.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's been around for so long. I remember going to sleep and having nightmares about the flashback last the creatures coming to get me. You know, Brooke Shields on Barracora, you know, coming out to get me and waking up in a sweat.
I have another question for you.
Go for it.
So how do you like the new job?
It's good. I get to work with your brother. It's fun.
Actually, I love you,
Brooke. Explain.
Oh, I am.
For those who don't know.
You know, to get into this flourishing industry as easily as I could, I took a job with Raw Thrills, who is Eugene Jarvis owns the company. Who did he did Firepower with Steve, and F-14 with Steve.
Superman.
It's at Atari. Superman at Atari. But he was gracious enough to offer me a job to run their accounting department. So I'm there now and having a lot more fun enjoying what I'm doing. So that's fun.
Last question is for your old man. I want you to tell us something serious here. I wasn't there when you were going to court in New York fighting for pinball. I want to hear some things about that. I would like to learn something tonight about what went down. In your own words.
God. This is good. For those who maybe have heard the story.
The documentary people can shut their cameras off.
That's right. We can fast forward. The whole thing started with obviously the pinball book and what have you. Did a feature in GQ. Gary mentioned and Rob did that I used to be managing editor there. did a feature that followed in the New York Times. We're looking at 1975 for that time frame, and got contacted by the New York Association. There's a coin machine association, and most of the states have some type of coin-operated amusement association that kind of oversees things for them and acts as a governing body, and if there's lobbying efforts that need to be done and so on. Anyway, got contacted and was asked if I would be willing to testify because they were going to come up to a court case to try to legalize pinball. And the first meeting was with a guy, God, I actually just remembered his name. Danny Frank was the PR guy. And we sat down. We actually met at the Broadway Arcade. And to give you a sense of things, Timmy, I know, knows the place. For those who don't know, Steve Epstein, he's a dear friend. They had, he and his father, an incredible location. It was on 52nd Street and Broadway in the heart of Manhattan. It was about a 15,000 square foot space. Upstairs was posters and a nut counter with the best nuts that you could buy anywhere, all fresh and whatever, games. Downstairs were the pool tables, which I think I ventured down there maybe once.
Table tennis.
Okay, thank you, Timmy.
Don't forget the skateboard upstairs.
Okay.
And the quick draw,
Oh, that's right, he had the old draw, unbelievable. So anyway, I met with Danny Frank at the Broadway Arcade, and that was our first meeting, and then the State Association had offices, I want to say somewhere like 57th and 5th or 6th, in an office building, and they outlined for me the approach that they were going to take, was going to be, and he showed me these large poster boards that they had done with pictures, and it was of all of the various peep shows that existed in Midtown Manhattan. And the approach that they were going to take was, if you accept this in and allow this, then you should be able to allow in pinball. And I said, that's great. If that's the approach you're going to take, I don't want to be involved. And we sat down and talked a little bit more about what I thought was a more appropriate approach, which wasn't saying, here's this cancer, and now we have this other thing that's kind of cancer light. So, of course, you want to bring this in. And said that, no, I mean, it should pass on its own merits if it is an issue of skill or what have you, and kind of outlined things. Okay. The nice thing was, and again, going back to the book, Rufus King was somebody that I had talked with on numerous occasions. For those who don't know, Rufus was brought in by Mr. Alvin Gottlieb and others back in the early 1950s to act as counsel on behalf of D. Gottlieb & Company and Williams. Those are the only two manufacturers that banded together. Eventually, it went before the Kefauver Commission. And it was the only Supreme Court case, and it was to rule for amusement pinball as compared to bingo-style pinball. A significant ruling. And Rufus, truthfully, was very much a legend within that. And we had talked because in doing my research, I wanted to get that information and try to bring that to life within the pinball book. And when they said that Rufus was going to be involved, it was like, my God, I get to meet this person. So that became much more of a motivation as well. Anyway, fast forward. The whole deal is that I'm going to go before the city council. Six members, somewhere in the Wall Street area in New York City, being incredibly claustrophobic, the idea of going before any council or any kind of thing in a controlled environment is not my favorite thing to do. And it was like, you'll testify, they'll ask you a few questions, and what we'd like you to do is play a game and just kind of demonstrate, you know, that it's skill-based. And Steve, I think if you remember, I know Mark probably does, Larry I think does. At one point in time, I was actually a pretty good player. So that was the setup. Go in. Rufus is there. I am having a panic attack because the place is packed. I mean, it's not like seeing Perry Mason on TV with like a few people. The place was packed. Lots of people, lots of camera crews and what have you, even more so than what exists now from major network stations. And here is this panel. Think of them on this dais up here, these six guys sitting in judgment. And I'm going to sit over there, no way in hell. I remember going out in the hallway, and Rufus coming over and said, "You'll be fine. You'll be fine. Don't worry. I don't know if I can do this. You know, how long do I have to sit and talk? I mean, I may want to go to the bathroom. I may want to be ill. I'm going to be trapped on this chair. Don't worry, we'll be here, we'll be behind you." And went in, and I know that Rufus testified first, asked him some standard questions and what have you, and he gave some historical things, and then it was my turn. And they called me, I went and sat down, you raised your hand, asked. I think the part that was so astounding to me was the nature of the questions that started out of the box. And for those who know the book and know that picture of me playing, there is a gray-haired gentleman that has a very gruff expression on his face. And this guy, I guess, was the chairperson for the city council, who just had an agenda, did not want to see this happen. Eleanor Guggenheim was the commissioner of consumer affairs in New York at the time, who was very much in favor of this. The industry had tried back in 1972 when Bess Meyerson was the commissioner of consumer affairs, and it failed miserably, hence the delay. Eleanor Guggenheim was predisposed to see this through, thought it'd be a good revenue stream for the industry. Now, understand, you're looking at a point in time before video games were really taking root. They're looking at a revenue stream. You only have a few areas in Midtown Manhattan that have games, old playlands and what have you. And it is. It's to what Tim was saying. It's a guy drawing. There was Hubert's Museum on 42nd Street with live ammunition, a shooting gallery. And it was skee balls, and it was other types of carnival types of games. It's all that there were. So I know in 72, just as a sidetrack to it, Williams and Gottlieb had created specifically for New York City games that conformed to being non-pinball machines. Planets, Zodiac, Michael, help me.
Bristol Hills.
Pioneer.
No, but the ones where you had a button on top, shot the ball up, there were no bumpers. All you had was like a little circular thing that like padded down on No Good Gophers, that kind of thing.
What?
Derby Day or Hay Runners?
Something? Yeah, kind of, but it was Zodiac and Planets, that I remember totally. There were like four games that were done for New York City that were pinball but not pinball. There were targets in the back that would have been like on an old kind of shooting gallery. Yes, Tim?
What about the horse racing game Derby? They had flippers at the bottom, but no real...
Right. That's basically what it was.
It was just horses.
Right.
Trying to get the...
It's kind of like
Hay
Runners.
Trying to get the right numbers first. But
right.
No bumpers, but just target number targets in the back. Like,
yep.
Like,
I mean, that's...
Like the baseball games.
Exactly. And that was the way that they were able to bring in quotes, a game with flippers. All right? So here I am. I'll go back to whatever that present time was in the courtroom. And the first questions asked are, after you give your information, who are you, where are you from? So who's paying for you to be here? I'm sorry? And this is from this guy. So if you know the book, know the picture, think about this person and that image of him watching me play, and here's this person literally attacking me. Who's paying for you to be here? Nobody. Understand that you are working on a book. Who's funding the book? What member, you know, what company in the industry is supporting your efforts? No, it's all independent. It's E.P. Dutton as the publisher and so on. But it was like putting me on the rack to try to, I guess, discredit whatever it was I was there to do. And basically, he got off that track. Eugene Mastropiore was the councilman who had actually brought the bill up for voting. He kind of took over with some questions of, so tell us, about pinball and what you've seen. Understand that you've traveled. I had done the traveling by then for the pinball book in Europe and so on, and explained that it was kind of everywhere and tried to give a history of things. I remember stressing, because it was really important to me, that it was a family business, but it wasn't a capital F. Because the assumption was it was all mob-based. It was something that was gambling, it was nefarious, it was terrible, it was so on and so on. So we went through all of that preamble, and then again, going back to this fellow. So understand you're supposed to be playing pinball for us now? Okay, sure. And they had set up two games. There was one which was an El Dorado, which is where all the cameras were set up and everything else, and over on the side was a bank shot. And the bank shot was there just as a fallback, because as we know, sometimes you can have some mechanical problems when it comes to a pinball machine. So I was like, okay. And I got up, took my breath, thank God, or I survived this. Maybe it was 20 minutes, half hour, who knows. I don't remember the exact time. I think that it felt like it was forever, that I was in that chair forever. And I went to head over, and this guy said, no, wait a minute, not that game. Play that one over there. And they had a recess for probably about 15, 20 minutes for all the cameras from all the news stations to move over and get the lights set and everything else. And the guy had just this look on his face as if that game's probably rigged. I'm not going to let you play that game. And I didn't even know what games they were bringing in, whether it was Runyon or Al Simon or whoever the distributor was in the area who brought in and provided the games. It wasn't like I said, here, these are my favorites. These are the games that were the current games. So we went over the bank shot and pulled back the plunger and played a ball and cradled the ball on the flipper and tried to explain what the geometry was and the rules. It's a pool-based game. These targets correspond to different pool walls. Here's your objective. There's two kick-out holes up here. There's stand-up targets here and here, lanes, and this is what you want to do. And there's geometry. I mean, the big thing that I wanted to stress was the fact that very much this was a precise science. There was a design. It wasn't haphazard. It wasn't something that was just arbitrarily placed. Truthfully, the guy did me a great favor. El Dorado, I got targets. It's a Western theme. What can I tell you? This, at least, I mean, had something thematically. It wasn't just an ABC lane. There were five lanes on top corresponding to 1 through 5 for the pool balls. So went through all of that. There was something that had happened in one of my travels. Excuse me. Coming out to Chicago, I had gone to a bowling alley in Skokie near Old Orchard. Doesn't exist anymore. And the games that they had in the bowling alley didn't have plungers. Because I guess what the city council there had decided was that a plunger was something that was a part of skill, or not skill, chance. So they had an automatic shooter, which now we all accept in this day and age, but back then, I just hated it. I mean, you just popped it in and it just kind of went, you had no control. And I remember that, and I also remember the stories about Hugh Hefner being very precise in how he played, going all the lines. So, to get the record straight, I think the second ball, might have been the third, but I think it was just the second ball, I basically said that, all right, there's five lanes on top. It's a five-ball game. There is skill back here, and if I do this just right, pull this back, I can land like in the center hall or down the center lane. And truthfully, I mean, if I would have realized the words coming out of my mouth, I never would have said it that way. Pulled the plunger back, went up, hit the stopper, came down, and thank you, dear God, went straight down the middle. And I know that people have, you know, heard the story different ways or what have you. The guy, again, going back to this person who seemed to be the ongoing nemesis, just said, that's enough. All right, I don't have to see anymore. And I was ready to keep on playing. It's like, there's more stuff for me to talk about, but I had called my shot, and that was it. I think in a matter of days, I heard that the city council voted 6-0 to pass. And as I've always appreciated, Mayor Abe being on my birthday, August 1st, signed it into law that pinball could be allowed back in New York. That's the story.
Huh? Is that a question at the end? I don't want to ask you any questions.
Don't give it to me.
Oh. Yes. So that's it. Thanks a lot for coming. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Last year, I heard one of the 16 Expo finalists talking about the tournament. And they said that Lyman Sheets was beaten by Josh and Zach's dad. I just wonder if you have any comments on how things have kind of gone full circle in that area.
It's that was an anomaly, but yeah, there was a point in time where they were my sons, and now I'm their dad. You kind of fade into the background, and truthfully, I don't mind it at all. So yeah, the dad did it. Scary thought. Yes.
Michael, have you ever used the kids for, you know, in the business for like maybe game brochures or anything like that?
Oh, here. Not pinball related so much, but Mortal Kombat, the first print advertisement. It's kind of funny, I was actually talking about this today at work, but for the first Mortal Kombat advertisement, me and Josh were in it, and it has Raiden and Kano coming out of the machines, grabbing us, and the tagline was, "So real, it hurts." What was that, JTC?
Yeah.
Yeah, JTC advertising, which is no longer, but... Yeah, we got $50 each, which was huge, being in like fifth grade at the time. Got free pizza, got to play the game for 6 hours before it came out. Telling all of our friends, this game's going to be huge, it's awesome. And people are like, what? Mortal Kombat? Never even heard of it. Street Fighter is better. And Mortal Kombat took the world by storm. Still is, isn't it? Like, in its 12th game now, maybe. Like, Liu Kang's dead now. I don't know what's going on. Yes?
I have a question for a father.
Hold on.
Father time.
Yes.
Roger, tell us about how you got tied up with Gameplan.
Okay.
From the beginning.
From the beginning?
Just not going into the design of it, but just how you got hooked up with that.
For those who thought that I actually worked for Gameplan, I didn't. So I'll set record straight on that one. New York State Association had a trade show in Stevensville, New York, and there was a fellow that some of you may or may not be familiar with, some in the industry that are sitting here probably know the name I'm about to say, but it's somebody that I had met when he was still at Chicago Coin, and as I walked into that show, Ken Anderson greeted me, and Kenny said, "Here." Just the person I was waiting to see. I was hoping you're going to come. I want to show you something. And he took me over to a cocktail table pinball machine called Real. And it was based on Real cigarettes. I guess it was a brand that whoever, Reynolds or somebody, had allowed them to do. And he said, "What do you think?" And there had not been a cocktail table pinball machine up to that point in time. It started something because subsequently there were a number of companies that wound up doing it. But the game played great. Did not know this company from a hole in the wall. Actually, they were under government contract doing business machines. So this was a side venture for them. And I told Kenny, I said, you know, I think that it's great, but there's no way in hell, you know, cigarettes and pinball. No, I mean, it can't be. And he said, well, I need you to talk to the president. There's a fellow by the name of Lee Goldboss. And maybe Rob and Mike at some point in time could track him down to Los Angeles and Las Vegas and have him come in and talk about the Real game plan story. But I remember going out to dinner with Kenny, my wife, and Lee Goldboss. And Lee's big thing to me was, I understand, but we have another one coming up called Foxy Lady, which was based on Black Velvet. I don't know if it's whiskey or whatever else. That was the follow-up game. And I was like, Jesus, you know. You hit me with cigarettes, and now you're hitting me with liquor. I mean, what else are you going to do with this? And I had a trade. The show was in the spring, and I want to say 19, had to be like 77. And I was coming out for CES. I was still a Gentleman's Quarterly. I was coming out for CES in the summer, and I did a side trip over to Game Plan because they wanted me to come by. And went in and met with Lee, and we just got to talking about things. I mean, he really had a bug about pinball, was hoping that maybe they could do a conventional game. They showed me around the plant. They were just starting an assembly line. And we got to talking. I remember being in his office, sitting across the desk from him, and he said, you know, for like a full-size game, you know, what would you do? And there was like a little piece of paper, a napkin or whatever else, and I did a sketch. And I said, here, but it would be too expensive. And I explained what the circles were. Those are bumpers, and these are targets. And this kind of stuff down here looks like a flipper, and so on. And basically, it was the design for sharpshooter. And he said, too expensive. He said, hold on a second. And he placed a phone call, and just a marvelous fellow. And I think that many of you have probably seen him over the past few years at the Pinball Expo. Wendell McAdams came in, and Wendell was his chief engineer. And handed over to Wendell, here, take a look at this, and I explained to Wendell, and Wendell looked up to Lee and said, it'd be too expensive. And my comment to Lee was, see, I told you. And what Lee asked next was, I guess, the turning point for me, for that part of my life, was he said, but would it be successful? And my comment was, if I knew anything about pinball, and at that point in time, I had played every game ever manufactured from 1966 on. Had traveled around, had played a lot of games, and had the great fortune of getting into the design areas of all the manufacturers, and Harry Williams is still alive and what have you, and really knew the fundamentals of things. More importantly, I kind of knew things just as a player. And I said, yeah, it would be. And that's how it started.
One more question.
Yes.
Are you sitting?
Yes. I think I am, unless I've become really, really short in my old age.
When your book came out, for the time, for us pinball players who didn't know about pinball or anything else, it was a fabulous book. How did you go about doing the research? How did you find these people to put together such a terrific book for its time?
It's interesting.
There was no internet.
There was no internet. Understand, and again, for those who know the story, I'll be really brief with it. For those who don't know it, I'll still be brief with it. But fundamentally, I wanted a pinball machine. And you have to understand, we're going back before New York had pinball. And I'm not going to go into the background of all why I wanted a game, but I was in a situation with GQ where I was overseeing all the non-fashion coverage in the magazine. And thought, what a great way to find somebody to buy a game. I'll do a feature in the magazine, and I'll find out how to do it. And went to the New York City Library, which is on 42nd and 5th. Went in expecting to find volumes upon volumes of books. There was nothing. I mean, flipper, pinball, I mean, any word that I could think of. There was one article from 1972, which was an Esquire, which really made Fireball the game of choice back then for those who were collectors and enthusiasts. It wasn't that it was Bally's greatest game. It was a game that was, you know, currently there on the line and one that they were pushing. And that's really how it all came about. I mean, I wound up going back telling the editor that it was going to be a little bit more difficult to do the feature because there wasn't any books. And he made the offhanded comment, well, you think you know so much, why don't you write a book? And it kind of started things in motion.
So
what was the question?
How did the industry take you when you went to...
Oh, you were asking about the how the research was. All right, sorry. It was a brain cramp. It happens, Rob. When you get to be my age, another 10 or 20 years.
Take about a suit of that fruit juice you got.
There you go. It was interesting because what wound up happening was... I wound up going through the Yellow Pages, gotta remember this, and saw under amusement games, vending machines, that there were some places over on 10th Avenue in New York City. Al Simon, there was Runyon, a couple of spots, and I remember going over there and discovered brochures, talked to some people, and trying to do, I mean, there was no research, I didn't know where the companies were, and you wind up looking at a brochure, it's Chicago. Oh, okay. I mean, I grew up in Chicago, I didn't know these companies were there. Happened to have had a visit at one point in time where Gary Stern was there, visiting Al Simon, who was the distributor for Williams. And Gary, for those who may know or don't know, his dad at the time, Sam Stern, was the president of Williams. And I had seen a couple of brochures and what have you, and I remember asking him about, I think it was Big Ben or something. Big Ben looked a lot like, God, Star Players. God, I'm getting old. I don't remember half the stuff. Anyway, but I just said, when you guys designed that stuff, did you know that you were doing it based on this, 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 or this? And he just was dumbfounded. The first trade show that I went to was down in Orlando, Florida. I got James Hamilton, who was the photographer on the book, to do the photography for GQ. And it was down there where I wound up meeting some people. And truthfully, it became a process of, I know this person who's a collector, here's a distributor, here's an operator, and you wind up going around, and literally it's a domino effect from one to the next, to the next, to the next. It was an arduous task. I still remember, hopefully Michael will appreciate this. I remember going into to meet with Alvin Gottlieb on one of my first forays into Chicago, and telling him I was starting to do work on a book, and he just gave me this look. This is a terrible look. But he opened up the drawer and he pulled out, I think it was actually a shoebox, and he kind of dumped out all these letters. And he just randomly pulled one out saying, hi, I want to do a book on pinball machines, and if you can provide me with this, 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 and this. And he pulled out about three or four letters which all said the same. And I said, no, I don't want you to write the book for me. I'm going to write it. I'd just like to be able to talk to you and get access to things. So I think that one of the turning points for me was Gary Stern going to my first AMOA in 1975 in Chicago. Back then it was the MOA, and it was at the Conrad Hilton. And I bumped into Gary, and he introduced me to Lex Pugh. Ask this guy anything. He knows everything about pinball machines. I mean, this guy is amazing, and going around and meeting people. And again, it became much more, we call it networking now. I think that it was just being incredibly lucky and fortunate. And at that time, to be able to be around people like Harry Williams and Steve Kordak and Gordon Horlick and Herb Jones and God, Sam Ginsberg. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Wayne Nines, Alvin Judd, and so on. And to be able to pick their brains, sit down. There are 400,000 transcripted words of tape that I did. Bill Gersh, another patriarch of the industry, especially in terms of really kind of bringing the business together and helping create trade shows back in the early 1940s. I mean, these are monumental people in the evolution and success of the coin-op industry, not just pinball.
And, you know, Roger, the timing was amazingly fortuitous, because if you look at it in the timeline, yeah, it was only a year or two later that many of these men passed away.
Yeah.
I mean, so part of what you're saying, my question would be, what was your impression of the age of some of these guys, and the fact that it's like, oh my God, this guy's, you know, he says he's, you know, he's in his early 80s now, especially some of the guys at Valley and Gottlieb.
I think the part that amazed me was, and again, I don't have the history personally, and I've talked about this in the past, so I won't delve into it now, but I didn't grow up with pinball. I wasn't related to it at all. I came in totally as a stranger, and I really came in from the point on from my years in college. So I did not have the familiarity. And to be able to meet these people who were responsible for these games, and to realize these people are old enough to be my father, my grandfather, but I'm able to talk with them on their terms was just astounding to me. And back then, and as I've already shown over the past few minutes, I used to have a photographic memory. And it was nice to be able to relive the 1930s with them and the 1940s and so on through. And again, to have that kind of bond. And to me, it really gave me an extra motivation. Look, the book took 3 years to come to fruition. Logged a lot of miles, spent a lot of money to make it happen.
I have a question about that, about the book. Now, I'm sorry, for those of us who walked in late, what's the name of the book?
Pinball, with an exclamation point. It was supposed to be Roger C. Sharp's Pinball, but we left off the apostrophe S, but yes.
I checked out a copy at the library years ago. I was honest enough not to keep it, unfortunately. Now, is it still out of print?
Yes.
Why haven't you reissued it?
Truthfully, I have all the rights. I've not found a publisher willing to do it, and I've talked to, Schaefer Publishing?
Yeah.
That does a lot of the books?
Schiffer.
Schiffer?
They did, I think they did Jeff
No, they've done an amazing number of books. I've talked to, I guess it's Peter Schiffer, right?
Yeah, Peter Schiffer.
I've talked to him years ago saying I had an interest in redoing the book. I would be willing to update it.
Perhaps.
Yes.
For nostalgia coming back. I mean, I'm not a smart person anymore. With the nostalgia coming back of all these guys around 40-ish that grew up in the arcades, maybe now they might talk to you. Just a suggestion.
I think that the bigger problem, and I know that Mr. Shaloub is here and he can probably understand what I'm about to say. The expense to do the book the way I needed to do it, the size, the amount of color photography, the separations, I think it becomes much more of a daunting task to have a book that was 90% color and we had some wells of black and white. But if a publisher is willing to do it, sure. I've actually thought of funding it myself. Yes?
A smaller, independent label with the internet, I'm sure it could be done. I mean, I would buy a copy myself, and I know others that would. Because it's going at, you know, shows out of print for like $100. Well, what if you reissue it? It's going to be cheaper.
I
would buy a copy.
I am more than willing and open to consider it. I've gotten older, let's face it, in all seriousness. To try to do the justice that I would want to do in bringing it up to date would be much more difficult, finding the equipment to bring it up to date from. I think the last pictures we took were around the time of Captain Fantastic and Wizard. I mean, you're looking at close to 30 years.
I want a CD-ROM version.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned it. One of the things I know I had discussions with some folks in the past was, granted, we did not do videotape, but to be able to hear Bill Gersh's voice and Herb Jones and Alvin Gottlieb and the others, I think.
Yes.
There you go. It could be kind of interesting. There's actually the original, I know that Shelburne and I had talked about it. There's the original manuscript that I did, which is... I guess about 3/4 longer than the ultimate final manuscript. Final manuscript was less than 100 pages. What I turned into the publisher was close to 400. A lot more detail.
He's a little long-winded.
No.
Hey, Rog, as closer to this question, what was the result of the book after it was published from your perspective? Was there a tremendous amount of feedback from the individuals, from the industry, or just not as much as you had hoped?
No, I think from the industry, yeah. I mean, let's face it, it admittedly opened a number of doors for me. It took my career on a different path than I had ever envisioned. It provided me with something that I am absolutely, totally, thoroughly in love with, and obviously with Joshua and Zachary sitting here, it has become... an integral part of their lives, and for that I am blessed. I think that the response out in the real world, look, I did all the major talk shows, the morning shows, talk about being claustrophobic and crazy. The Today Show, which was being done live, and maybe the tape exists somewhere, but is it really? It's scary. It was with Tom Brokaw, who was, I guess, one of the new morning anchors. And I was there at the time with Sylvester Stallone, whatever movie that he was pushing. And we were sitting in the green room. And I am agitated beyond belief. Because, unfortunately, about a week prior watching, I want to say that it was John Hartman was the host on the ABC morning show. He was David Hartman or whoever it was. He was an actor, but he became like a news type person for them. But he was interviewing this woman who was promoting a book. And it was toward the break. And you know how the cameras used to, well, maybe you don't know, but the cameras used to kind of go back and forth. So the camera was on him. He asked the question, goes to her, she gives the answer, asks the question, goes back to her. And for those who can't see it, all you see is this woman's face like, and it goes back to him. Are you okay? Goes back to her. And they break for commercial. It's the break at the half hour, so you get the local news and everything else. And it comes back after they've done the news. And it's like, we've gotten, and there's no faxes. There's no emails. We've gotten a number of phone calls and whatever her name was. was okay. She just wasn't feeling good, so not to worry. So, of course, what's emblazoned in my mind, as I've revealed to everybody, is I'm going to find myself on live TV before millions of people, and I'm going to be this woman. I'm going to be freaking out. And I had gotten to the studio at about 4 o'clock in the morning. Runyon and Mondale and Al Simon were just fantastic because they provided games for my appearance. We had some stills that Jim Hamilton and I had gone through that they had blown up. If anybody has seen the stage set, so we had these huge visuals that I actually have at home that they had done where they hand-painted in. So there's this whole backdrop. It's looking fantastic, and I am panicking. My sister is there, who was in public relations at the time, said, "You'll be fine. Everything will be fine." And I had gone back home to change, come back. The guys who thought I was part of the setup crew couldn't believe that I was actually the author that was going to be talking about his book. And I am freaking out. I'm not going to be able to do this. And they had a health person back then, and for those in New York, Tim, you'll probably remember, was Fred Fields. He was a newsman, and he was their, he was a weatherman.
Frank Fields.
They called up Frank Fields, and they brought a car for him, because he lived in like New Rochelle or whatever else, to come in just in case, I don't know, I dropped dead of a heart attack or something. And my sister's saying he'll be fine, and Stallone is there with his people, not knowing what's going on with this person, and I am sweating bullets, and it is time for my segment, and I guess Brokaw had also heard about what was going on. It's like, you'll be fine, everything will be okay, and it's like, I understand, it's okay. I'll tell you what, if I just get like white or whatever else, I'll just like walk away. You have all the games here, everything will be fine. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we were on camera, we were rolling live. And for those people who subsequently said, you were great, but Brokaw was just terrible. Jeez, I couldn't believe it. It was like, well, now you know the backstory of why he was terrible. He was waiting for me to, I mean, to explode at any possible moment. But, I mean, again, to go back to your point, Rob, Bruce Jenner was a featured reporter for the ABC show. I actually had him in my apartment to play my games for a segment. Did a lot of TV. There were a lot of magazines that picked it up. Gene Shalit made it a prime choice on NBC for a holiday book because it came out around Christmas. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. Truthfully, to this day, I still have never read the book from page one through because it hurt to make the cuts that I had to make. But I had an obligation to bring the book to print, and despite the fact that the editor had a change of heart midstream, I followed through with it. But I think that, and to Michael's point before, the timing was right, not only for the people that I was able to reach out to and to bring to life on the pages, but also the diversity of locations that we were able to highlight visually in the book throughout the United States and throughout Europe. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore.
I
was just going to say that I think that it hit it at the right time. The legalization of pinball obviously helping. I also stepped in Chicago and a court case in Ohio and another one in Wisconsin and a couple other places during the same time. But I think it gave a voice to, here is this wonderful piece of Americana, and it's out there, and hopefully there was a crest that was written. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, not to change subject. How many games are in your collection do you lean toward Williams or Gottlieb? I gotta know.
All right, answer.
How many games? Go ahead. You started and Zachary can answer.
I have no idea. I moved out, and 11 games went out. He moved in, and now games are going back in. I think, well,
how many do you have?
I have 10, because I just sold one. That's
what. What are some of the titles? Some of the titles.
I have a Cyclops that he owns. My oldest game is an Air Aces that Jim Padla did. And my newest game is Attack from Mars, probably. I don't know. Drag. My newest game is an Ultra Pin. For Brian. That would be my newest pinball machine. But it's all over the map. We grew up playing old stuff. I think at home, his your oldest is Buckaroo, probably.
No fault.
A five-star final, you know, the real
fire.
improvements of Bagatelles.
What's Roger's favorite? What's your favorite game?
Oh, wait. So, do you have any games?
I have four.
It's an infection. See, it grows. That's why.
Yeah.
I have a Cybernaut, which was the first game I got, for $50 because Josh found some ad. Somebody was selling a game. They needed to get rid of it. We drove over, looked at it, and I'm like, I'll pick it up. Why not? So we got it that night, and that was my first game. Second game I got is Jumping Jack, which Ken Walker helped fix and works beautifully now. And third game I got is a Frontier, which I'm trying to make it work. Josh, help me. And fourth is, I plan on selling it, but it's a Roller Coaster Tycoon. Cotton Candy.
And that's where we differ, because my sons are willing to sell their games and I'm not. I think I have 22. I mean, favorites obviously are the ones that I designed. I mean, I still like those. Williams versus Gottlieb. I always thought that Gottlieb had better flipper games. And not just layout, I'm just talking about just the action and the accuracy of the flippers. If you go back to the mid-60s, I mean, the favorite, yeah, is definitely Buckaroo is the first game that I got. Central Park, Hurdy Gurdy, was a game that was the first game that I ever rolled and beat when I was in college. So that has a warm spot in my heart. Flash and Black Knight 2000, I mean, personal favorites. I think it's all over the lot. I think when people have asked me in the past, you know, what's my favorite game, I've always looked at it from era to era. I have a Mills official. Thank you, Mark Wayne, for doing such incredible work on games and restoring and refurbishing them. I think that each game has its own unique qualities, and you may not like it on balance, but I've never believed that there's a bad game. And trust me, there have been some terrible games, but Popeye. Right. I was thinking Dolly Parton and some others, but we won't go there. But I think truthfully that any game that has ever been designed, there's somebody out there that is going to find it interesting and fun and exciting and something special for them. So I don't know if it answers the question necessarily, but yeah.
What are your thoughts on Medieval Madness? Is that like $1 million now or something? Or what are your thoughts on that game? Is it worth whatever it's going for, Medieval Madness?
I think Medieval Madness is a fantastic game. I think that Brian and Lyman did a great job in terms of you know, what they did with the layout. I think the balance on that is a lot better for me personally than Attack from Mars. I think there's more things that are going on in terms of your shot selection. I think it's a remarkable game. I think that the prices of machines today are just, you know, silly. But I also can appreciate and understand that every single machine built is a limited edition. It's just a question of how limited it might be. Adam's Family. I know I have that at home as well. I mean, what a remarkable game. And I think the question becomes much more, what are you looking for in a game experience that you're going to play repeatedly? And again, different than my son's, where you're thinking at some point in time trading in or selling, that's going to become a functional part of your life. So,
We have space limitations.
Space limitations? No, you just need to have understanding with family members. Thank God my wife's not here to share, you know, since she's lived with all of this and we don't have a living room anymore. Well, and truthfully, thank God for Larry DeMar and the magic that he has with any lock known to man. And helping me get the heads off of the games, because the house that I wound up moving into and buying when I moved back to the Midwest, I actually thought you could make the turn going down into the basement, and you couldn't. And without Larry's help, and I know Ed Boone was there, and Steve Ritchie, and a number of other guys, number one, bringing the games into the house, disassembling them, reassembling them, couldn't have done it without him. And I know at Funland, we did not have the key for that. Larry was able to somehow magically open that sucker up. Otherwise, it would probably still be in the garage today, or maybe I would have broken down my wife earlier to allow a game in the living room, where we now have six or eight now. So, not counting the two antiques in the dining room, but it's okay.
Yeah. What's the difference between doing licensing for a pinball versus a gambling game or a video game?
For those who didn't hear the question, I guess, what's the difference between doing licensing for a pinball machine versus a video game or a slot machine? I do slot machines now for a living. For those who don't know, I'm the licensing manager for WMS Gaming when they went over to the dark side, decided to close down pinball. But I also do consulting and admittedly did all the licensing for Williams Bally Midway from 1988 until we shut the door, and that was for video games as well as pinball machines. I think truthfully, the dollars are different on some levels. The upside potential in terms of a gambling device, the expectation. What you have, truthfully, and it's changed a little bit in looking at both, because you have to understand, the first licensing that I did in 1988, other than what Tom Neiman had, you know, done back in the late 70s, early 80s with Bally, nobody had really done licensing in the coin-op industry. It kind of went dormant. Was to break down the barriers and to educate people to the fact that this is this industry, meaning coin-op. Pinball's a good thing. It's not in, you know, bad places, or a video game is a good thing. I mean, to negotiate with the NBA for NBA Jam, and there had never been a license from a professional sports league for a coin-operated amusement game, was a significant thing to deal with. More recently, and not telling tales out of school, and Dwight kind of lived through some of this torture and torment, was the amount of time that it took for me to break down the walls with Disney, because they had never done a coin-operated amusement game license before. I'm not talking about an interactive game. I'm talking about one of their crown jewels with Pirates of the Caribbean, turning it into a pinball machine that's going to go where? It's family entertainment centers. It's Dave and Buster's. It's Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, you try to give the bright side of it rather than them thinking that it's going to be in some seedy bar somewhere. NASCAR, which I worked on for Gary, a little different type of resistance. But with gambling, it's the same thing. It's a slot machine. And it's very difficult. If you go back to the first license that I did for WMS, which was Monopoly, Wheel of Fortune hadn't been out yet. I mean, nobody was doing licensing at the time. And to begin that process, which took me 7 years to work on acquiring and securing and negotiating that license and educating them to where the world of slot machines were going, was for me very, very similar to what I had gone through repeatedly with pinball machines and or with video games. So it's a different awareness on the part of whether it's studios or lawyers or what have you, that are representing personalities. Whoever it is that you're dealing with on the other side who has the license that you want to acquire, it's their level of familiarity and their expectation. So it's kind of the same, and the audience kind of transcends it. So so many trips. Yes. So I don't know if that answered the question. Yes.
I got a question for all three of you to answer about the difference between a father's pinball experience when he plays with the son. Based on these assumptions, Roger, I'm assuming that for many years, 100% of your pinball playing experience was putting coins into a game, not home games or anything like that. Whereas I'm going to also assume that sons always had a home game available. What is the difference between how you felt when you played pinball and how you guys felt?
Good question. Even though we always had pinball machines at home, like, I always got a joy going to arcades and playing playing pinball machines and even video games. It's like, there was an arcade just for fun that was like 2 minutes away from our house, which we weren't allowed to walk across the street, but still did. And they had like a collection of 12 pinball machines in all really good condition. And we always went with our friends because they had like 8 tokens for a dollar. And even though we could play it for free at home, there's always games that we didn't own that you'd want to play. Like, even though it's still pinball, I mean, there's different themes, different games that you want to play. And something about getting out of the house, no offense, Dad, that, you know, an arcade experience can bring to the table as opposed to just playing at home for fun. Yeah, Josh. We'll go in age order.
I think, I'm sure Zach agrees, but I'm sorry. I'm not used to this. No, I'm sorry, Steve. In growing up and having games at home was fine because it obviously got us, you know, obsessed and hooked with it, which continues today. But some of the greatest joy that we get is being able to get to play a game for the first time. And, you know, back in the days when we were children, Just for Fun was a Williams test site, and probably a test site for the other manufacturers, may they rest in peace, that were out of the time. So we'd be able to play the newest games the day they would come out. We'd beg our dad to tell us, you know, what's coming out in 3 months, and he would never tell us what was coming out, which was bad. But we couldn't get that feeling at home of being able to play a game for the first time. And, I mean, it's even grown through today where, you know, designers like Steve and Pat, who now let Zach and I, you know, into their doors to check out games as they're in progress. I mean, we're so excited about that. I mean, it's unexplainable. And you can play a million games at home, but to get out to Stern to play new stuff, and then when it gets put on location, to get out and talk with people that are playing it and put coins in it is just a feeling that you just can't replicate.
Yeah. I'm amazed at the fact that there really has been the transference between what I used to do, when I used to come into Chicago from New York and sit down with the designers and kind of go through things, and they'd ask my opinion and what have you, and here my son's doing the same thing and providing input, whether it's programming, whether it's geometry, game rules, and suggestions and input. It's great to see. But having said that, I think that I always felt within me that at some point in time, and maybe it's already happened or maybe it is yet to happen, that maybe my sons would appreciate just how lucky they were to have just a big kid as a father. Because, excuse me, not only did we have pinball machines.
It's okay.
I'll get the cleaner. Okay.
Yeah, really. Yeah. But we had every video game system known to man with all the video games. I mean, that was my world. I mean, I enjoyed that. You know, I had my NES system with my little Robbie the Robot, and I had my 7800, and I had all these things, and it was all there for them.
We used to call the Nintendo Helpline for
yes,
hits on Zelda, we get stuck.
Dragon Warrior.
So I think that, you know, truthfully, I still enjoy. I mean, I come home at night from work, and I mean, the current game of choice for me is NASCAR. And I'll play one or two before I, you know, kind of get myself together. But it's still a way to unwind. Absolutely still enjoy it. I think probably less so for me the level of urgency that Josh and Zach have of wanting to get to Galaxy Games or Galen North or whatever else because there was going to be the new Gottlieb game there that night. Okay, I'm not coming home for dinner, dear. I have to go race out because they're going to have Bone Busters, and I have to see that before anybody else does. I have to play that. And spending the time to, you know, to go there and be there first and get a sense of things before anybody had seen, you know, the game. And I think for me now at this stage of the game, there's less of that urgency. So when the guys say, so you're going to go over to Stern? I mean, we're going there tonight. I'm tired. I'll go home. There's something on TV. Maybe I'll go next week. So I think that part, at least that urgency, has kind of changed for me. But in some ways, maybe I feed off of what they say, and it's always nice when they come home. All right, so tell me, what's the layout? Well, it has ramp over here, it does this. And for them to be able to give me a visual image is great because it's we're able to communicate on a totally different level than I think a lot of parents and their children can do. And maybe in some ways, you know, the way I viewed many of the people who shaped the industry and thinking of them in a more paternal way is maybe the way I view myself if I step back for a moment from what I have as a traditional father and son's relationship, and even to the point of my stepson and my two grandchildren and the fact that they have a game in their house. And seeing that as another generation of children playing is just, I mean, it's remarkable to me. It's an affliction. I apologize for it for them, but I'm glad that I was able to infect them. Yeah?
Everybody refers to pinball as an infection or a drug. drug or addiction.
Never. I hate those words.
I see this group of people from all walks of life, different socioeconomic groups, different backgrounds, and their one thing in common is this absolute passion for the game.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? What is it that drives that passion, and is it just a game? What makes it more than a game?
I think that there's a life force. I mean, I know that we had talked before, and I guess the analogy that I'll use, and I'll defer to anybody else to step in and see if they would agree or disagree, is that I've always thought that, and maybe the boys were not as specific as they might have been given time to think about it, but I've always thought that the experience of playing the first pinball machine was something that people would always remember. It was like the first time you ever kissed somebody. There's a warm spot in your heart. There's a story that goes with it. You're on a family trip. You stop at a gas station. There was a game there. They put in a nickel, a dime, a quarter, whatever, and you played this. You may not remember the game and what it was or the color, but you just remember what that life experience was, and it is wrapped up in a family memory that is timeless. I mean, even for the sake of Josh and Zach, it was in the living room. It was there. I mean, it was a part of their life. And I think that that is something that is unique to pinball. I've said it before. I'll be curious, if I'm around long enough to see it, whether or not in another generation there will be the people who grew up with video games who will have that same memory of the first time you ever played a video game. And whether it was a coin-operated video game or a video game at home. And I think there is some kind of a life force that exists between us and pinball, as players, as enthusiasts, as collectors, and what have you. You don't have to be the best player in the world, but you can still get enjoyment. And I think that it's different in regard to any other type of diversion, sport, activity that exists out there. And I think that that is what breaks the mold and makes it a universal experience for everybody. So, and again, I don't know if everybody here would agree to that premise, but yeah.
Well, I should add something. I think there's also a sense that pinball needs defending, that it's going to not have enough momentum if we don't keep it.
I think for the group here, you're right. It does need defending, and I've preached that for years in terms of growing the base for Pinball Expo and so on. In fact, let me ask everybody a question here. By a show of hands, how many are here for the first time?
Right here.
That's great. Excellent. Next year, come back and bring somebody else with you. Bring two more people with you, because that's how you grow the base. I think that for those who are here, we're different than people in the outside world, and our experience with pinball and our affection for it is totally different. But if we could transfer that, there used to be an old Fabergé organics commercial on TV where you tell somebody, and suddenly the screen fills. That's the human cry that we need to do. I mean, it's the purpose, going back to it and not trying to advertise it necessarily, but it's the purpose and the rationale behind starting again the IFPA. There's a community out there. Let's bring these people together. Let's see if we can empower people where before the industry tried to do it from the top down. The purpose of IFPA and the WPPR is to bring it from the grassroots, from the players on up, and create some momentum. Create, again, some empowerment. So if we can do that, then hopefully it's not a question of just salvaging it. It's a question of really savoring it for what it brings to all of us. And my hope is it brings us little bits of joy whenever we play a game. Yes. Howdy.
Interesting family dynamics, the sharp parcel, when the son started winning on a consistent basis against the old man.
I don't know. Do they win on a consistent? Yeah, they probably do. Yeah, it was.
Huh? Those are nice power battles.
Let me have them answer. Is it interesting to beat me?
To whip me, I still have my moments. But yeah, it is. I'll tell you, the part that I have found intriguing as a parent, whether it's pinball or anything else, I mean, normally, for those of you who are parents, there are points in time where your child has done something, and I'm thinking in a good way, and there's a family member or a friend or a neighbor or somebody who says, So wow, I mean, did you help him with that project at school? And, you know, God, he's so good. Did you work with him to, you know, get his skills better or so on? And I think for me, there were questions when I allowed both of the boys to start competing in pinball because I have Papa Four, thank you. Because I would think about competitive pinball. But to watch at various points in time some of the technique and some of the skills that they have, I have just stood back and I've had people say, God, I mean, did you work with them? Have they practiced? I mean, is it like, do you force them to play twice, you know, 2 hours every night before they go to bed to hone their skills? And no, none of that. They just pick it up on their own. And for me, it is a miraculous sight to just see some of what they are able to do and say, my God, I mean, even in my day, I don't think I could ever do that. And to realize that somewhere within themselves, there is that competitive spark, and more importantly, the dedication to the art of skillfully playing. I'm dumbfounded by it. So there's a lot of pride there. Yes?
I want to add something to just my observation. How old were you in 94, Josh?
15. Okay. Depending on when in 94. 14 or 15.
I knew Josh when he was really little, and he looked at the cute kid flipping the flippers. And this cute kid, look at this cute kid who can make shots and flip the flippers, and it went on and on. And the turning point of this cute kid that, you know, is going to one day play pinball was in 94, the IFPA.
Is this World Cup size?
Yeah. The IFPA in its early incarnation had these big tournaments in Chicago, and Josh was playing in the kids' division. And these games are set really mean, no extra balls. And we're all playing it, and the people who consider themselves pretty good players were having their heads handed to them one after the other. And all of a sudden, there's some excitement going on, and this guy is getting to the final World Cup match on a game with no extra balls, set up meanly, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, welcome, he's here.
Yep. $7 billion? $3 billion or something?
I think it was about $7 billion on the tournament.
It was amazing.
And I lost the match because that was only one game. It was best 2 out of 3, and I choked on the other two. So there you go. But it was a good game.
Who won? I'm just curious. Who ended up winning?
The 12 and under division. That was you. But we didn't have to play
All right, so I actually have a question for my sons. So who's the better player?
Go ahead.
I am. No. I think on any given game, like, we always equate pinball to golf, and on any given Sunday, you know, anyone can win. You know, obviously from a ranking standpoint, I begrudgingly say Josh is better than me, but, okay.
I think in one of the ways that I've become a better player, and I think it's sort of the difference between how I approach a game of pinball and how our dad approaches a game of pinball, I look at a game, I try to find a weakness, and I try to exploit that weakness for my own game. Whereas, you know, my dad will sit and shoot a ramp over and over again for no points because the shot feels good. And it's like, you know, what do you do? Like, he'll play for an hour and a half shooting, the Adams Family Bear Kick ramp over and over again, and then, you know, lose to us. And, you know, it felt so good. But I think you get to a point where you develop your skill set to a certain point. You can do things like... you know, pass the ball, flipper, and watching Dwight play at the AMOA tournament and seeing some of the advanced skills that he was doing that I wasn't aware of, that you get to a point where you just kind of can do what you can do. And if it happens to you, you know, Sunday, if it happens for me or Zach on Sunday, great. If not, I think we're still just as good as anybody else. And there's a very large pool of players that can win this weekend.
What I'll add in, because one of my concerns was, and even in asking the question, was the competitiveness or lack thereof between, you know, both of my sons. I mean, I didn't want it to be something where, you know, it was cutthroat and sibling rivalry or whatever else. And I think the most gratifying thing for me was the last PAPA that Steve and I basically put together in Las Vegas, where my sons teamed up. God, that was awesome to see. And out of nowhere, there were these two little children. What year was this?
I didn't grow until. Right. I was 17, but I was like 4'2", so we were little.
But I mean, out of nowhere, playing against, you know, truthfully the best players in the world at that time, and there was a big contingent that came over from Europe. I remember that, from Germany and Holland and England and from Japan, and watching my sons just kind of cut through everybody in doubles and watching them feed off of each other. I mean, it really was a collaborative effort where I've teamed up with Larry, who is an exceptional player, and for whatever reason, both of us would try too hard if the other one wasn't being really good. I mean, we didn't feed off of each other in a positive way until we really didn't take it all that seriously in the last IFPA, and we actually did pretty okay. But otherwise, it was like, God, I let him down, I gotta try harder, which of course, if you're playing pinball, means it's a total and utter disaster. I mean, we could never get cooking on the same cylinders and things, or playing the old California style with Steve.
California style, yeah.
That's right, slapping trash. But I think that, truthfully, that was a turning point for me to see them play together like that, and it was great. So, anyway.
Question, real quick. Zach or Josh Sharp, when you guys were at Carlisle, what was your experience with the tournament? I always get confused with, you know.
Yeah, but we're used to it.
Yeah. Our mom messes us up.
Okay, so what was
it? I can't tell them apart.
Okay, for those of us that missed the Carlisle show, which was like last week or something, what was your experience with the tournament? Did you play? What do you think? I mean, how did you do?
And for those who don't know what they're talking about, if you can explain what happened with Carlisle or what it is. And
should Josh start off? Yeah, no.
When we made the announcement, I guess, for when the IFPA was coming back to life, there were some people that were like, what can you do to help? We have a show and we'd love to have a tournament. And, you know, we've gotten really hands-on with Jimmy Rosen was the guy who ran the Carlisle show. And over the course of, God, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, we talked through every step. We developed tournament software from the ground up that we're hoping to be able to give on our website for future tournaments for people just to download software and be able to go. So he was one of the first tournaments that we really started from scratch and built up. Unfortunately, I had a wedding to go to, but Zach, along with Steve, handled the whole thing, which I think went well.
It went well for you.
So. Kind of went well for me, and also Martin right here. Basically, me and Steve ran a show. Steve and I, thank you, Mr. Copywriter. Anyways, Friday started off a little slow, and things were kind of nervous in terms of the turnout of players. The show hours weren't that great. And then Saturday started a little slow, but then things started picking up. We're like, all right, this is gaining some steam. We also had a little kids tournament there. It was a Zizzle. It was on a Zizzle pinball machine, which you can see upstairs by the Pirates. Thanks. And basically, the high two scores won the machine. Getting ahead of myself. First place won the kids' Zizzle machine. Second place won some NASCAR machine that Jimmy...
Karam
NASCAR hockey game. And it was great to see, because at first there was only one kid who played, and it's like, oh, congrats, you are in first place, and you're going to win. Good competition. But then finally, one other kid came in and played, and then knocked the other kid down. And it was like, wait, I'm not in first anymore? And then all of a sudden, there was probably, I'd say, over 40 entries in the one day on Saturday, and kids were crowding, trying to see, like, oh, am I still in first? Some kid played, even though he was in first, to try to bump up the score even higher, and he didn't even want to play at first. So for me, that was probably the highlight of the weekend, because just to see kids getting into something that they... I think we said 12 and under, even though we weren't carding them.
No, but just so that people understand, I mean, you're looking at 12 or under.
A young player base.
It makes us feel a different generation.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the kid who ended up winning was so excited. I mean, he doesn't know the difference between, like, a real live pinball machine, but, you know, it's created awareness in these young boys that pinball is fun and competitive pinball could be even more fun. And I know there's a lot of naysayers with, you know, Ultra Pin and the Zizzle, but you know, if you really want to, you know, pinball to grow, you need to build awareness. And for some people, you know, that's their first inkling of pinball. And you know, when they see a game that's broken at a bar, you know, they're turned off to it. But you know, if you get kids playing these games that are a lot of fun, you know, it gets them into the spirit of things. The whole weekend ended up being a very successful show. You know, much congrats to Jimmy and anyone else who helped. On a personal note, I did pretty well. I got first place, and I also won the mini tournament that was there as well. It wasn't rigged, don't worry. And no, it just showed the possibility of any tournament anywhere can be successful with enough exposure and enough notice for people to come out. I mean, we had people coming from all East Coast states, somebody from New Jersey, I think five different states people came to play. And it just goes to show that any tournament can be successful.
Have you won a tournament before?
Nope, inaugural tournament for them. And, you know, a healthy cash prize, and it was successful, I'd say.
Well, when we were talking at, when Dave was talking with us at ASI about when we were starting stuff, and you were asking, you know, what are your guys' intentions? That's really our goal is we see what, if you just work with these people and you work with, you know, it's a sales pitch to a guy that's walking across a tournament booth that, you know, it could be a hot dog stand, he doesn't care, and you get in their face and you talk to them, explain to them what's going on. And I'm sure my dad had the same experience at AOA, but to be able to focus your energy for one particular event and to see how successful it becomes, just repeat that 1,000 times, then, you know, there's 1,000 events that keep going. It's just, you just need that hands-on. It doesn't happen, you know, like that, but, you know, we're trying our best to one tournament at a time, one step at a time.
One player at a time.
One player at a time.
Yes?
What's the California style you just...
Steve,
did you want to answer that?
I didn't hear what he said.
The California style of pinball play.
It's sort of like spray and pray. It's like paintball. You know? A lot of shots and...
It's a lot of slapping and stuff.
It's a lot of slapping. It's like mostly like...
Hyperball.
Prevention of the ball going down the drain.
at all costs.
At all costs.
That's right.
All the way to tilt sometimes.
And Mark and Steve epitomize that. Just as a basic skill level. Doesn't mean that they're bad players. Just we used to joke about it, that's all.
The way that we all played with at Williams, it was like, you know, I'd be playing along, I remember Larry especially, like that. Man, we know the glass isn't going to break. So that's what we all started doing. Okay, then I go to an arcade and do that, and they come running. Do it! I don't even know! California style.
Most definitely. Well, let me thank everybody. We actually made it through, at least I did, and obviously you did as well. People seem to be somewhat still reasonably awake. It was a pleasure. Hopefully there's some stuff that people got out of it, and I think Gary has a few comments that he wants to make. So.